You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of October 24th, 2018, and this is episode 500. What?
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Alboy.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. And boy, howdy, have we been doing this for a year or two.
Woo, just a little bit. Just a little bit. Time flies when you're having fun.
Time flies when you're talking incessantly about video games.
that's very true, actually.
And to mark the occasion, we've done like plus or minus 500 shows, which
It's definitely plus.
You're right. That's true, actually, because there's some unnumbered ones or some weird ones. So we've done more than 500 shows, and we've seen some stuff, some big trends in the video game industry. And so war never changes. Also, war has changed.
Yes, significantly.
And it's our goal to figure out whether the Fallout Man or Solid Snake is right this week. and figure out, just talk about some of the big sea changes and some of the bigger industry trends we've seen over the past 10 years or so of doing this. Because in a weird way, it goes gradually. And then I like to think back to what was going on in 2008. And it's like, man, things are actually quite a bit different.
Yeah. You know, when I was thinking about this, I was thinking about how before we started this podcast, you know, I still played a lot of games. I still talked about games, but it wasn't really like a major focus, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a part of my life that I really was like obligated to do in any way, shape, or form, right? Like,
it wasn't something that I had come to slowly hate.
Well, no, no, more so that like it's not something that I would start to catalog, right? Like this conversation of like, oh man, how have games changed over the past years or so? Might have come up and probably did come up, you know, in 2010 or whatever.
Yeah.
But I hadn't been paying attention with the same level of astuteness that I have been for the past decade or so since we started this podcast.
Right.
And I think that there's actually quite a bit that has changed or we've seen change, and thinking about it is kind of a fun exercise. Also, it makes me feel really old.
Yes, I try not to think about the fact that it's that many years. I try to think about it in terms of trends and not years, because that at least lets me obfuscate the kind of relentless passage of time.
That's exactly right, yeah. We're just in the battle royale phase, you know? It's not like a year or two thing.
Right,
yeah.
My back feels fine. I'm totally not older and fatter. It's totally great.
Yeah. Do you, out of curiosity, like genuinely speaking, when you think about how you play games, well, maybe not how you play games, but how you think about games, do you think that there's a generational gap? Like, do you feel old? Just to say right off the bat, I generally don't like the concept of generation gaps, because I think it tends to divide people more than generations actually do. But, you know, people make jokes all the time. Oh, God, like, why can't I just get a video game that has me grinding for loot in caves or whatever the fuck, right?
Right.
Like, do you feel that at all?
I don't know. I guess I should make more of an effort to talk to, well, just to talk to people in general, but to talk to people that maybe have a more significant age gap. Like, I don't, because I hear anecdotally, like, you know, for example, our neighbors next to us, those kids are in high school or middle school, like siblings, and I know they play Destiny. Or at least they did play Destiny a year ago. Like, I don't know if they've kept up with it or whatever. And so,
I mean, were they raiding and shit, or
I don't know. I don't know what their light level was, but so it's not just like they're not just like standing on top of the roof flossing. You know, like there are, you know, there are some commonalities between us, and so it's probably not as different as I would suspect, even though there probably are some large gaps.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That I find that reassuring.
I mean, I talked to someone at work who works on, you know, one of the teams I'm on, and he's significantly younger than I am. Like, I don't know how much younger. He's, you know, maybe somewhere between 8 and 10 years or something like that younger than I am. And he expressed similar sentiments to me around how he was talking about driving games. He was like, well, they've just gotten so complicated that I can't really get into something like a Gran Turismo anymore because I don't have the time or the bandwidth to learn how to play this game. It's like, okay, well, at least I'm not the only one feeling like the Maddens or the FIFAs of the world are going in a trajectory that I can't follow. And so that was kind of interesting to me. Because he was significantly younger than I am. So, I mean, it's, so maybe there, it might just be more of a time and place thing than a general, a segmented generation thing.
Yeah. The one thing I find myself feeling old when I'm talking about it are basically story games or like narratives in games. Because that's something where, you know, when we talk about like, oh, wow, you know, we're in an era, and maybe this is getting a little bit of ahead, but we're in an era where we can have AAA games with really compelling stories like God of War, for example, and there's a lot of praise for it. But sometimes it feels like people who maybe don't have as much of a gaming anthology that they've played over the many years don't quite understand how impactful even like a... for example, you might think that the God of War story is actually not very good. But compared to the past like 20 years of games, it's one of the best, right? You know? So it's one of those things where it's like there's been so much progress that I think sometimes people don't fully understand. Like when I'm talking about why I think a game is interesting and I'm talking about the narrative being interesting, that is a rare gem. I want people to pay attention to that.
Right. Well, and that might be just as much of a function of how into the pastime people are, because you could probably say something similar for someone that has never seen The Godfather or something like that and has only seen modern crime dramas in movies.
Yeah, that's true.
Where it's like, oh, you know, there's a bigger lineage here. It might change your... You know, you might not be as blown away by The Departed if you also saw these other movies or something.
That's a good point, actually, because that's very much the case with horror movies, where you'll see people of like, oh, I don't see very many movies, but I saw, like, I don't know, The Conjuring 2 this weekend, and I thought it was pretty good. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, go see, I don't know, The Exorcist or something. But then you're just like a douchey movie snob.
Well, yeah, so then you just become a weird medium hipster or whatever.
Yes.
About the pinnacle of each medium. Anyway, yeah, it's hard to identify it.
Yeah. Well, shall we get into some of the things that we have seen or have noticed in terms of sort of the major changes since we started this here
podcast? Yeah, let's do it.
One thing that I want to talk a little bit about is the sort of gradual evolution of open world games. I was thinking about the very first, again, I work for Ubisoft, but I have to mention Ubisoft because Ubisoft makes a lot of open world games. The very first Assassin's Creed game that we played, and I think we talked about it on the show, and you really didn't like it, and I was telling you that I loved it and that I was collecting all the fucking, like, flags. Do you remember how the game had, like, all these useless collectibles?
Yeah. I remember that.
Were impossible to track, but in order to 100% the game, you had to go find all of these flags. Now, open world games haven't changed that much. They're still like...
now we're collecting seeds in Zelda, well, and it's fine.
I mean, it's... Yeah, exactly. Like, it's not that big of a difference, but I think for something that could have really become an isolated genre, it's now so expansive that we get really interesting versions of open world games in different ways, right? And I'm kind of surprised by that. I think that this could have been, you know, this could have been the sort of like MOBA genre. Like, I don't think there's any sense or inevitability to the idea that open world games would be where they're at today. But I think there's been a lot of innovation over the past years that it's really interesting to recognize, right? Going from something that, you know, there were some open world games that still showed some linearity, right, in terms of what you had to do, even though they were ostensibly open world. You could look at something like, I don't know, like OG Grand Theft Autos that were open world, but maybe there wasn't all that much to do, or like Far Cry 2, which itself was interesting because it really leans so heavily on the systemic interactions with the world that open world games really learned from and applied over the years as they went on and on. But now, you know, Red Dead is coming out this weekend. There's a huge amount of content in there. There's open world games where, you know, the almost more like an MMO style, where there's all of these sort of like living, breathing events that are happening simultaneously mm-hmm. as you play. There's just a lot of variety now, and it's kind of interesting to watch how that's changed over the years.
And it's also been because there have been a lot of them, where I feel like Grand Theft Auto 3, of course, kicked things off in a big way, but probably around the time when that first Assassin's Creed came out, that started off the Assassin's Creed franchise, which has been hugely influential. But for two, I feel like it influenced what an open world game could be, just in terms of size and scope and what you could do with it, how you could have an open world game that wasn't GTA. Basically, you don't have to have cars, it doesn't have to be in a modern setting. And I think it's cool to see the innovation happen in volume too, where there's just a lot of open world games. It seems to be a perennial format of game now, in a way that is, I mean, if you think, like, how many big, huge AAA platformers do you get compared to big, huge AAA open world games? Like, I would argue you get more open world games than platformers, which is which is crazy. You know, I mean, those are big, expensive games to make, and yet they continued to slowly iterate on all of them, to the point where now, you have another Red Dead, you have you know, new Far Cry's coming out all the time. It's interesting to see that trend just continued to grow instead of flattening out at any point.
I also love the idea that, as I recall, back in, say, like, the, I don't know, Skyrim, shortly after Skyrim mm-hmm. era, there was a sort of dick measuring contest whenever a new right. open world game would come out.
They miles is your map?
Exactly. Or like, we're 3 times the size of, you know, New Angeles or whatever GTA world they were in, right?
Yeah.
But now at this point, I feel like everyone's just pretty much recognized it's fucking huge. There's a lot to do. Don't worry about it. It's really big.
Well, and you have games like Red Dead who are making a new argument of, well, this world also has a clockwork system in it where there's real characters. If you don't see something on screen, it's still happening, you know, blah, blah, blah.
And in a way that, I mean, that you can trace that back little by little to all of these open world games. But that idea, or at least that feeling, right, is something that you could have experienced in Skyrim. It's just gotten sort of better and better. And that's kind of cool to watch.
Yeah.
How about you? You got any...
Mine's also a design thing, but it's a little bit more conceptual, where the progression mechanic, just progression as a whole. Mm-hmm. And the way I think about this is, it's a little bit fudging because I think it all started around 2007, not 2008, but the influence that Call of Duty Modern Warfare had in just character progression as an incentive to keep playing a game, was just hugely influential. Just like, looking back on it now, of almost every game I play has some sort of progression mechanic, and no matter how well I'm doing, I'm always seeing some meter increase. And I kind of track that back to Modern Warfare, and it's just, I just think about that and how influential that was.
Yeah, it's so easy to forget how things weren't always like that.
Yeah.
I mean, because I distinctly remember talking about Modern Warfare as well and saying, oh, that's cool because you can, you know, unlock these traits and change. Like, what was it? You could, I don't know if it was Modern Warfare, but one of them, I remember the first time realizing you could change your, like, death ability. Remember mm-hmm. there's, like, last bullet standing? There's all these, like, special tier things that you can unlock as you play. And get to a point where you really feel like you're customizing all of your shit.
Yeah.
And it's cool now because, well, I don't know about cool, but it's relatively cool. We're at a point where there's not just one now. Like, there's multiple, right? There's, like, progression systems for your guns.
Yep.
There's progression systems for your characters. You also have a meta level for you as a player that then also progresses to unlock things. And, I think Modern Warfare is a good call out. You see this also in other non-shooter games. Even the way that, you know, League of Legends has missions and things to work on and progress just through play now, is a pretty drastic change to that game system since it first came out, where there was really no progression other than earning gold and buying characters. There's now these, like, huge, you know, secondary monetization systems.
Yeah.
I mean, which also, I guess, is its own thing as well. Like, the way that that has then tied to the way that games monetize over the past 10 years is fascinating.
I mean, the those two are very joined, where you can either play the game for longer or you can, you know, buy into the economy. Even the progression system of something like Overwatch, where they've divorced it from mechanical influences, where it's not like Call of Duty. You don't need to grind to get your special in Overwatch. It is simply aesthetic. Time-based. Yeah, I mean, it's so it's just such a compelling structure for people, for better or worse. You know, I mean, there's been a lot of controversy over it, you know, for especially for blind boxes and randomness of rewards, but I don't think there's any arguing that it fundamentally changed what we, it fundamentally changed how we expect to be, I guess, almost compensated for our time in a weird way when we're playing a game.
Yeah.
I mean, to the point where I think there's also some backlash. You know, I think the whole Dark Souls thing is almost a backlash to that sort of progression.
Which dark? Oh, you mean the how there is no progression?
Yeah, Souls genre in general to me feels like at least an implicit response to the participation trophy
that's true.
Culture of those types of shooters.
What I will say to the credit of like different monetization schemes and unlocking things, though, and this is sort of another thing that we've seen changed, but the way that companies have been able to monetize games after the fact through like passionate but potentially small player bases has allowed games to, and again, for better or worse, launch essentially not very good and crawl their way back into not just being good, but being great and being hugely popular. You know, you can see it in even something like Fortnite, right? Where like that game was I guess, because technically Fortnite was a game before the Battle Royale component of Fortnite was.
And technically, Fortnite still has a mode called the Save the World mode or something where it's like not the Battle Royale mode.
It's so weird. I think, I mean, going back to Ubisoft, but Rainbow Six, right? Like that game came out and did not have the massive, passionate fan base that that game has today.
Yep.
And it's largely because companies are able to monetize and sort of adapt and have that sort of relatively steady income. And I think that to games credit, it means that games have now are now able to evolve in a way and receive feedback from the community in a way that just wasn't possible, I think, at the scale that it is today when we were, you and I were first starting this show. Yeah.
And you've also seen enough of the success stories where it's easier to make that argument, where whether it's Siege or whether it's Grand Theft Auto 5's multiplayer, whether it's Fortnite, you've seen enough of these high profile cases where you can make the argument that no, it's worth supporting this game, just give us enough time and we'll figure it out. And that argument is more sustainable now because it's worked. You know, it's worked in multiple areas. So,
well, it's also not worked in multiple areas.
I mean, like, that's fair, but I mean, bad games have always been bad. It's super rare to have a bad game that then becomes good.
In a way, it almost feels like a form of vindication, because you can say, well, you know what? You had a lot of time. You know, you had your chance.
Right.
Didn't work out.
Right. What else? I have a couple others. Do you have any others you want to put in?
Yeah, one I want to put in is, I don't know really what to call this, but essentially like always on, specifically like multiplayer games where they're always, it's something is always going on, right? It's not just like this game comes out and then you play multiplayer for a while and then you're done. And
I you think mean this like season-based stuff?
Season-based is season-based is a perfect example, right? Or I mean, going back to Rainbow Six or GTA, right? Like I remember there was a time when a game would come out and it would feature multiplayer and maybe there'd be one or two or three patches and then that would be it. And then you just get the next one. You know, you'd get the next Call of Duty or you'd get the next Halo and play multiplayer there. The idea that there's a real chance that any major shooter or major multiplayer game comes out, even if it has a single player game, comes out and is just on forever. Yeah, there's a real possibility, right?
That's true, yeah.
I've been playing League of Legends for almost 10 years.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would have predicted a game to be able to exist for 10 years and still be new and still having them pumping out creative, because, you know, you and I grew up in a time period and and started playing games in a time period where it was like Smash Brothers, right? Like mm-hmm. a multiplayer game would come out and it would never receive even a single patch. You would just, right. that's it, because people were not consistently connected to the internet. Yeah. And now that they are, it means they can push changes. They can iterate so much faster than they used to be able to. And you can monetize, again, going back to the monetization concept, you can monetize in different ways according to seasons and according to flows, and have these things that are just, they're just forever games now. And yep. that's totally the norm. And I think if you were growing up now, especially if Fortnite is one of your first big multiplayer experiences that is defining your youth, you were just growing up in a period where like forever games are just totally normal. And that's crazy.
That's a good point. Yeah. The expectation almost. I mean, it's actually kind of piggybacking on our last topic, which is, it's not just that games are patched and evolve, it's that the expectation is there that they will.
Yeah,
it's like exactly. a game releases and the first thing that people say is, when's it being patched?
Well, can you even imagine like Red Dead with no DLC? You know, like yeah. that would never exist. That's right. just, it's incomprehensible now, you know?
Right.
And every time I finish a game that's great, I'm like, oh man, I wonder when's the next chunk of DLC gonna come out, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
Become a demanding asshole is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's like the lesson over the past 10 years is you could just complain and you'll get more and more of your favorite game.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me throw out an uplifting one out there. Okay. I think Japanese game design has been an uplifting story of the past 10 years. Where if I think back to like 2008, it was kind of a dark time. For people that yeah. like games coming that came out of Japan, and now, especially after last year, with both like Nintendo firing on all cylinders, but From Software is doing its thing, Nier Automata did its thing. Like, there's just so much more out there. It feels like Japan had a rough go of it during the kind of Xbox 360, PS3 era, and then yes. really turned it back around in the next system of segment of consoles.
I remember there was an article around this time period that was basically saying, like, what happened to Japan? Like,
right.
Why is it in the constant feud between Japanese RPGs and Western RPGs, Western RPGs won, or something about Western game design won, right? We lost the iconic games like Metal Gear or mm-hmm. Armored Core or some of the, like, non-RPG games that sort of defined Japanese game design for a time period. And I do remember thinking that was it. Like, Japan was just like,
right.
Japan was just going to be this, like, now just this home of like weird weeby JRPGs, and that's about it.
Yeah.
Because the West had won. But you're right. I mean, we use Breath of the Wild as an example to go to all of the time, because, I mean, again, it's Nintendo. So it's
yeah.
always, you know, they're always a company to be excited about. But Breath of the Wild is one of the best open world Western RPGs, not made, or one wasn't made in the West. You know,
right.
it's phenomenal. Yeah.
Well, and also there's something just clicked. Like, I remember a couple years ago when Metal Gear Solid 5 came out, and
yeah.
all of a sudden I was like, man, this is actually, weirdly enough, this Metal Gear Solid 5 is, again, one of the best open world games that I've ever played. And it's also extremely Japanese in terms of the attention to detail and the complexity of all of the various systems in it, but they clicked in a way that something like, I don't know, what's a good 360, Lost Planet or some shit, you know, something from like that era yeah. of games, where it's like, man, Japan is really trying to figure it out. And to their credit, they seem to have figured it out somehow.
Yeah. I wonder what it is. Do you think that maybe it's like a complexity of, because when I think of Japanese games today, like Souls and or mm-hmm. Sekiro or, you know, any of the games that were shown at Tokyo Game Show, there's a sort of complexity right. to their design that I think maybe people are excited about again.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, I bet you, I don't know, we're not, I'm not technical enough to make a good assumption about this, but I have kind of an amateur assumption that I bet that they weren't prepared for how expensive and time-consuming it was going to be to make games in the HD era.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because even Nintendo wasn't. I mean, Nintendo put out an SD console in well into, you know, the time when people had already switched over to high-res assets. But all that shit is way more expensive, and they were the games did not increase in price commensurately, so I bet you it just took them longer than they expected.
Just organizationally, essentially.
You know, asset pipeline and like just project management. It's like, oh man, like, what do you mean you don't have that rock texture done? It used to only take you a day. It's like, oh, sorry, boss. Like, it takes a lot longer now.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's interesting. Well, I mean, actually, there are one or two bad things. Like, for example, like Konami imploded. That was a bad thing.
They had it coming, though.
I feel like Capcom has had some weird up and downs over those past 10 years.
That's true. Yeah. What is Sega doing these days?
somewhere they're working on Seaman 3 somewhere in a bunker. Oh, God,
I hope so. Let's see. I think for my last one thing I want to add that I think is kind of interesting that I've seen over the past decade or so, and something that I've seen this year, is just the variety of tones that are tapped by games these days is really quite impressive. And I'm thinking back to the early 2000s or the mid 2000s, when every single cover of a game was like some dude walking away from an explosion, or there was the weird edgy phase. It was like a teen edge phase with Prince of Persia going edgy. Oh yeah,
we talked about that with our Edgelord podcast.
Yeah, exactly, the Edgelord podcast, right? Like, there was this phase where all of the AAA games were trying to sort of be in this race to be to do a particular tone better than everybody else. And now, you know, this year alone, we saw something that is as mature and dark as God of War, but we also have something as fun and jovial as Spider-Man. Yep. We have Overwatch that swings back and forth between the silly and the serious.
Mm-hmm.
We have Breath of the Wild that feels more like fantastic and lighthearted. There's just a lot of variety in the tone of the games that we play. Or even something like what's the Don't Nod's series of narrative games that I love and I can't remember for some reason, but like those
Life
games
is Strange.
Yeah, Life is Strange, like those games are about really small scale like emotional drama, and mm-hmm. that range that we have access to now feels new. And maybe it existed 10 years ago and I just didn't know about it, and maybe it was only something I could find in indie games if I just put in the homework, but I don't know, it feels like we have an access to this tapestry of emotions that we just didn't have access to a decade ago.
And or at least they're just not being dismissed out of hand, or they're getting the right amount of attention or funding or whatever.
Yeah,
it is
funding, yeah, for sure.
But I think you're right. I mean, I definitely, when we were first starting out, there was way more, there was just more of a word of mouth where you had to find something. Like, this was like even pre-itch and, you know, aggregation for independent games. So it was even harder to find that sort of stuff. You just had to kind of find the creators you like and hope that they updated their website. I think there is more of a, or at least there's more space. Like, I don't even know if they've gotten even more or less popular, but just things have been expanded out. There's just more space for them to exist.
Well, and there's more of them, right? Like, I think games like, what, in 2009, like Uncharted 2 stood out because it had a tone that was unlike so many others. But now you can get, Nathan Drake has been copied as a protagonist many times over by a variety of games.
Yeah, that's
true.
It's
easy to get that sort of tone now. You know, but going further back, like, what are we looking at? Like, Tony Hawk or Halo? Like, those are pretty consistent. You know, even something like Bioshock that stood out as this weird, one-of-a-kind thing. You know, tonally speaking, isn't that much different from some of the other dark post-apocalyptic stories we had access to in the mid-2000s.
Yeah, I agree. And I bet also that's part of, there's, you know, the, it's not, progress is not a straight line, but I think there has actually, if you look at it with a long enough time frame, I think there actually is more diversity of developer experience and developer background.
Yeah.
And that is reflected in, the most banal example is there's just more parents making games now. So all of a sudden, I mean, the explosion of like dad games that have happened over the past 5 years or so is basically because now all the people that used to be making Quake are now parents.
Yeah. And they're selling to consumers that are parents.
Exactly. And so it's like, you can kind of see the subtle shifts. And I think there are, we still got a lot of work to do, clearly, but I think you see more of that in all kinds of in all factors of the audience, whether it's you know, race or ethnic identity or gender or what have you. There's still not a lot, but there's more diversity out there. Yes. And it is reflected in even the most popular games, even if it's only a little bit, and definitely yep. much more so in the indie scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's see if I talked about Japanese games. I had esports down.
Esports.
I mean, esports was definitely a thing, but it was mostly one of those things where I was like, oh yeah, those are like those crazy Korean people that just play StarCraft. Yeah. And now it's like, hey, Rick Fox just bought an esports team or whatever. And it's like, yeah. it became a thing in America in the same way that it became in Korea. And I didn't even quite realize that it was happening.
Ooh, loved it. I love, man, by the way, we used to do like check-ins on League of Legends.
Yeah.
It's a world championship season. So I'm like heavily into esports.
Yep.
Heavily into League of Legends esports. This is the fucking year, Scott. There are no Korean teams in the finals.
That is crazy. That's a huge thing.
Of the four teams left, there is China,
mm-hmm.
two European teams, and a North American team.
Interesting.
This is the year we've ascended.
It took the entire globe's forces to be marshaled, but finally knocked Korea out of the tournament.
But to your point, right? To your point, I think this is evidence of that, right? Because yeah. we're talking about organizations that have developed and grown in financing, in infrastructure over the years to really make esports across the board a healthier climate for creating the best players in the world without yeah. having to forge them in a country that's been doing it for years.
Yeah, yeah. I'm still not good enough to play any of them, but I guess that's kind of like a me problem.
That's very true. Yeah, I mean, I think esports for sure is super fascinating, and it's still, again, still young, still changing. But what's great too is we're at a point now where it doesn't really fly anymore to come up with an excuse of like, oh well, you know, esports is still young, so we're still learning. Like, nah, man, like it's been around long enough where yeah. we should be measuring up ourselves against, you know, other major sports in terms of how players comport themselves, how organizations comport themselves, and how companies and publishers create healthy esports environments.
I mean, especially when you compare it to anything besides the kind of top four sports or whatever in America. Like if you compare esports to even like AAA baseball or something like that, like I'm sure the payouts on the championship teams for esports are bigger than some of the minor league or quasi-professional teams of physical sports out there.
Oh yeah, no doubt. I mean, they are making some scratch for sure.
Yeah.
So right. Does this conversation make you excited for the next 10 years of games?
I think it makes me more observant if I see a trend and to think about, I'm hopeful that the next time something comes along, like, you know, like the progression mechanic or something like that, where it's like, oh wow, like I should keep an eye on this and see what happens.
Yeah.
Because it can just happen quickly.
Yeah. I love being dismissive of things and ideas. as you clearly know, things like VR or, you know, or the battle royale genre, right?
Yeah.
But you're right. Who knows? Because there are things that maybe we wouldn't have predicted a decade ago that could be very much defining of the medium in 10 years, you know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, and part of it is just it's hard to see that stuff in the moment where, you know, for better or worse, things like the iPhone or the Nintendo Wii or, yeah, anything that broadens the genre is hard to see in the moment, where it's like, oh man, this is fundamentally actually going to change everything. We just won't be able to see it right away.
Yeah,
that stuff is hard to see. But looking back on it now, it's like, man, that actually, I didn't really think about the iPhone as it was happening. But even my for something like Facebook games. Remember when Facebook games used to be huge?
Yeah.
And it's like, why did Facebook games, why did they go away? It's like, well, you know, the companies were run poorly, no one liked monetization, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, actually, it just all migrated to phones. Like, all that shit is there. Like, the same exact bullshit that was on Facebook games is now on the App Store.
Yeah, for sure.
And we just don't see, I personally have a hard time seeing it in that way because I don't necessarily always make the connection, but it's totally that way. Like there are things that influence each other that aren't actually, that are just kind of adjacent and not in a line towards each other.
And some of them are on the Nintendo eShop.
Yeah, exactly. You hated it on Facebook and on iPhone. Now hate it again on the Switch.
Ooh, clicker games. Let's go.
Hey, clicker games go back to our first thing. The meter's always going up.
That's true. Always going up. We got to click.
All right. Well, it was a fun little stroll down the macro memory lane. ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And ExperiencePoints.net is our Department of Long-Term Thinking. We're planning ahead, nice. Baby. The next 100 years.
This is our bunker. It's like it's like the what do they call it? Like the seed vault or whatever. For us, it's games.
Yeah. Yeah, you're going to dig me up and find my copy of like Chrono Trigger. It'll be great.
Yeah, just in case nuclear winter happens or whatever, we'll have a pristine copy of Chrono Trigger. For
bury me with JRPGs and then list them all out on my tombstone and see if anybody digs me up.
It's like, he has an original cartridge in there.
What?
Like the ancient pharaohs of old, you will be buried with everything you need for the afterlife.
Oh, hell yeah, dude. As long as they get like some nice like Mother 2 walkthrough, I'm ready.
Why is George wearing his Earthbound t-shirt? And that's what he needs for the afterlife.
Exactly, yeah. It's a long boat over the River Styx, dude. You gotta have some games to play.
We put all of these extra Switch battery chargers in there because who knows how long it will take to cross that river.
Oh god, that's hell right there, dude. My battery dies.
No, I forgot them all.
I had time now.
Oh, man. All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for listening, especially after all these years. And we will be talking to you again next week.
Ciao. Every time we